Good evening. I always stand in wonder each year when I come to this year. It's just hard to imagine that another year has passed since I gave the share last time. I thank the Rabbeinu Shel Olam that Baruch Hashem were able to come together to focus a little bit on an appreciation of the Chag. And come to a thought, a discovery in life that the more something is sanctified, the holier it is, the greater the obstacles to access it. There's a Mokum Kodesh in Eretz Yisrael where the distractions are just awesome, more so than almost any other place in Eretz Yisrael. And I told my brother-in-law, a margish to Kedusha, the sanctity, is very special there. And because it's very special, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam has created distractions. And we have to see past the distractions in life to capture the essence, to capture what's significant. Pesach has been my entire life the most wondrous of the Yom Tov. It's totally in a league of its own. And it's been in the imagery of Klal Yisrael the most unique of Yom Tov. And that's almost why it's the most difficult of Yom Tov too. We need to push aside, focus on the difficulties and capture the essence of the Chag. This Chag, it is so easy to get caught up in all its challenges that by the time we're through with that, who has energy for the Chag itself? And come to this later a little bit at the end of the share. But it's important to do what we have to do. And what we don't have to do, we shouldn't do. You know. And this has been a cottage industry as old as the Jewish people. That it stems from very holy things. We wish to fulfill the Dvar Hashem in its fullness. And consequently, we know no limits. And the Poskim have sanctified that as well. But we still have to have limits. So we'll talk about that later at the end of the share. But I want to focus a little on what the essence of this Chag is. The very beginning of the process of redemption from Mitzrayim, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam appears to Moshe Rabbeinu. Where does he appear to him? The first time that Moshe Rabbeinu comes in contact with the Shekhinah is in the desert, and he comes to the Sneh. Lavas Eish mitoich Sneh. The Midrash says, Lomo mitoich Sneh, velo mitoich Ilon. Why in the midst of a thorn bush and not from a tree? Why did the Rabbeinu Shel Olam choose the place to appear to Moshe Rabbeinu for the first time? And this begins the ascent of Moshe Rabbeinu to become the leader of Klal Yisrael, to being the Redeemer of the Goyel, to take us out of Mitzrayim. Why does this take place? B'toich Hasneh. Oimer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam declares, Imay Anoichi B'tzar, I stand together with you in your hour of difficulty. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam Mechol Tzorosam Leitzar, in all the travail of Klal Yisrael, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam shares in that travail. V'heim Nesunim B'Shibut, my children are persecuted, they're subjugated. Nigla mitoch ilan acha. I should appear to them from a tree, from a place which is comfortable, from a place which is beautiful. Lefigach mitoch hasneh, shakulo mole koitzim. It's a thorn bush. All that's there is thorns. Wherever you touch it, it's a painful experience. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam declares, Boni matem l'Hashem Elokecha. We are his children. If it has been deemed in heaven that our lot will be a difficult one, and even with good reason, but the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is not happy. Is a parent happy when he sees his child suffer? So the Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, Imo Anuchi Bitzoro, I join together with Klal Yisrael in the time of your travail. If you are in a difficult place, then I'm betoy chasna. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam is mighty. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam is above everything in this world. But he appears to us betoy chasna, to demonstrate to us that he identifies with us where we are at presently. And therefore, mitoy chasna, thus begins the career of Moshe Rabbeinu. His first pekisha, his first meeting with Shechina, is mitoy chasna, in a thorn bush. In every situation that we find ourselves throughout all of history, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam stands with us. We have varied symbols of the Seder. We have matzah. Matzah, as we declare, is shelo hispik b'teikom shelo vaseinu lahachmetz at shenigla aleyam melech malchei amlocha makodesh baruch hu. We didn't have time to complete the task of making bread. Matzah is reminiscent of the geula. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam took us out of Mitzrayim. It's time to leave. There's no time to wait. So we come back to the matzah as the sign of our redemption. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam arrived. We must depart. We have recollections of the bitterness too. Tomorrow, we can never appreciate in life redemption and freedom if we don't have a perspective on persecution and servitude. A person that was always free and was always comfortable does not understand the gift that he has. Ramei Chodosh, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha, the Mashgiach of Chevron Yeshiva. So he came there to Yisrael with the altar, 1924. His children were born in Eretz Yisrael. He told his children, the joy of coming to Eretz Yisrael, you will never know. You will never understand what that is. As we stood on the ship, we approached the shore and entered the harbor of Eretz Yisrael. The joy that we knew, you will never know. You were born in Eretz Yisrael. To you, that's life. It's axiomatic. Only when we have a perspective on the morrow. But what's surprising is the Seder. We have the matzah, we have the morrow. But we also have the kerach. We have the matzah and the morrow together. And Rabbi Yoshua Zatzal says, this symbolizes the fact that even in the darkness of the Golos, we can sense the presence of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. How the Rabbeinu Shel Olam preserves us. One sometimes has to be a remarkable personality to see it. One of the personalities that I'm enthralled by is that of the Klausenberger Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha. the more that I learn about him, the more I'm inspired by him. The father of one of my cousins was with him at the time of the liberation in Feldafing at the end of the Second World War. So he was a remarkable personality. And a man that suffered greatly. Lost a wife and 11 children in the Holocaust. And barely survived himself. And yet, he told his Hasidim that in the darkest hours of the war, I saw the Rabbeinu Shalom's presence. I want to belabor it now, but he was a person that in the midst of all the suffering and all the difficulty, but he felt connected to the Rabbeinu Shalom. Korach symbolizes, there's more. And at times the more is in the ascendancy in life. But nevertheless, we can sense the Rabbeinu Shalom's hand. We can sense that he's with us. Imo Anochi Vitzar, the Rabbeinu Shalom is with us. And he's the one that sustains us in the Golus. According to Rashi, Rashi tells us in the Sechta Megillah, why do we have a bracha? Ra'inu avonenu v'rivu arivenu, baruch atah Hashem goyel Yisroel. We have a few brachas later, t'ka b'shoifu godo l'cheruseinu, we ask the Rabbeinu Shalom to redeem us, ashiv v'shofteinu, v'lu v'shalayim ircha, es tzemach. All of these brachas that deal with the geula. So what is this bracha that we have? The fourth bracha of the middle section of Shmoneh Esrei, Ra'inu avonenu v'rivu arivenu. So Rashi tells us that this refers to a different geula. Not the geula which will come with Mashiach, but rather the geula that the Rabbeinu Shalom sustains us in the Golus until Mashiach comes. Not an easy task that we've had, but it is the most wondrous aspect of history. For many years, I taught 10th grade. So I like to be on top of what my students were studying as well, their secular studies. So I used to thumb through their books a little bit to be familiar with what they're studying. And according to the current high school curriculum in 10th grade, they do what's called global studies. Right? What we called in our day world history. We took it later on in high school, but they do it in 10th grade. So I pick up the book one day and I start thumbing through it at the beginning. And it lists the ancient peoples of the world. So I stop on this list and I tell my Talmidim, let's read this list together. We have all types of people. You can't even find them unless you are a very successful archaeologist. You'd have no idea who they are. We have in Chumash, we have the Chiti. For 2,000 years, at least, 2,500 years, 3,000 years, nobody knew about the Chiti, who they were, what they were. They thought they were a people that came from the Middle East. Where were they? What were they? What was their kingdom? And then early in the 20th century, they discovered the Hittite kingdom. They deciphered cuneiform tablets, and they began to learn about their history. And they, in fact, came from Europe, somewhere in Turkey, in that area of Europe. But they were a world power. They controlled a big part of the Middle East. They were an extremely powerful and aggressive and militant people. And yet, Abraham Avinu dealt with them, with the Chiti. 1,000 years later, 1,500, they disappeared. Nobody knew about them for 2,500, 3,000 years that they existed off the face of the earth. So I went through the list. The only one on that list that's still around today, the Jewish people, from Abraham Avinu until today, was still here. The Yavetz writes in a Siddur, one of the most remarkable things that I've ever seen. Rosh Shiva Rav Henoch, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to quote this Yavetz quite often. And one time I decided it's in a very, very lengthy preface to his Siddur. to find it. It was a daunting task because the Yaivet's preface to the Siddur is very, very long. But eventually I did find it. And he says the following. He says, Chaynafshi, he says, I swear to you that the miracles of the survival of the Jewish people in Golis surpass the miracles, all the miracles that are recorded in Tanakh. Yitzias Mitzrayim and everything else, our survival in the Golis transcends all of those nisim. And we could see nisim, if we study the history of our survival in the Golis, we'll see nisim that are greater than the nisim of Yitzias Mitzrayim. That's Korach, in the midst of all the difficulties that we may have. We've had no shortage of difficulties in our history. But we sense the Rabbeinu Shalom's presence. And he says something else. That Matzah lo hispik b'tzeikom lahachmetz. We ran out of time. Things happened quickly that we were redeemed. And therefore we could not complete the task of making the lechem, the bread. And that's equally true of the ultimate gula. When Mashiach comes, the Novi writes, Pisom yovoy alecholu ha'odor asher atem uvakshem. Suddenly, Mashiach Tzidkenu will be here. Yesterday looked dark and bleak. We couldn't imagine that we would be redeemed. And what's tomorrow? A new world. So this is the Korach. It is more. But the Matzah tells us that the Rabbeinu Shalom is present now and will be present in very sweeping terms in times to come. The grandfather of Rabbi Yosef was a very, very great Mekubal. So was the Leshem. Leshem was a very saintly individual that came there to Yisrael circa 1920 and lived out his life there. And he writes that if we examine Yitzias Mitzrayim closely, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam pulled out all the stops. More than was necessary. So the Rabbeinu Shel Olam could have taken us out of Mitzrayim without such a show. The Nisim and the Kriyas Yamsuf. Says if we examine the Mark of Dever. Dever does not seem to be such a miraculous event. The Rabbeinu Shalom brought a plague and varied people were afflicted by it. Right? We have flu epidemics all the time in the world. It did not seem to be something so extraordinary on the face of it, out of the realm of the natural. And he said the Rabbeinu Shalom could have taken us out of Mitzrayim, as the Chumash tells us specifically in the beginning of Parshas B'Shalach, without Kriyas Yamsuf. But why didn't he? He didn't want to take us in a way that we would wind up in warfare right away and we would be deterred from leaving. So he made a different pathway for us, which necessitated going through the Yam Suf. So the Rabbeinu Shel Olam pulled out all the stops. For what reason? To show us that we, Klal Yisrael, are not limited by the laws of history. History, nations rise, nations fall, they come into existence, they become extinct. That's nature. We don't live by the rules of nature. By every rule of nature and by every rule of history, we shouldn't be here today. Mighty nations that rule the world, their cultures disappeared completely. And without a Jewish commonwealth, and with all the synonym that we've had throughout all our history, we're here to tell the tale. And that was the message. The message of Yitzias Mitzrayim was not only for that one moment, it was for all of history. That we are above and beyond all the rules of nature and all the rules of history. And there's a symbiotic relationship between ourselves and the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. The Midrash tells us, "Vayavov b'nei Yisrael b'soch hayom vayavosho." We entered the sea, and it became dry. And Rav Meir has his interpretation, an interpretation that we are not used to. Rav Meir Omer, Kishomdu Shvotim Al Hayom, when the 12 tribes arrived at the shore of Yam Suf, they were vying for the right to go into the Yam Suf first. This is the view of Rav Meir. And they were debating who's going to have this chus. It's kofat Shevet bin Yamin bin Yorad Yam Tchilot. So Shevet bin Yamin went, and that's it. They just jumped in. It's Chilo Sora Yehuda Marag bin Oysam Bavonim, and Sora Yehuda said, "You don't have the right to precede us." Moshe the Mahadover Doima. This is analogous to the following. There was a king, and he had two sons, and he gave them conflicting pieces of information. One of them, he said, he goes to his youngest son, and he says, "Listen, the moment the sun rises, I want you to wake me up. Okay? Come tomorrow, whatever, 6:40 in the morning, bang on the door until I get up." And he tells the elder of his two sons, "Tamideni b'sholoshos, wake me up at 9:40 in the morning." So you can imagine. So his eldest son is waiting at the door until the appointed hour. His younger brother shows up at 6:40. He wants to bang on the door. He tells him, "No way. It's not happening. My father said he's getting up 9:40. Dreiminish kankop. Don't make me nuts, you know. 9:40 it is." So Amalei lo Amalei, Yelat Shalosh Shoyes. Rakot Namalo Alamanei Tzachamu. So here they're arguing, who's going to prevail? So in the midst of this debate, Neir Aviam, the king, wakes up. He says, "Amalei bonai, kol shneichem lo niskavantim elo likvodi. Both of you came here today to my door to honor me, to show you respect for me. It's not material to me if it's 6:40 or if it's 9:40. What's important is both of you came. And the whole debate that took place amongst you was solely for my honor. What's the best way to honor me?" He says, "Therefore, I'll reward both of you." It's Kach Omar, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam said, both of the Shvatim, they're vying. What's the debate between them? It's who should have the right to serve me, to honor the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. It's Maschor Not or Shifto Shel Ben Yomid. That the Mizbeach was in the Chelek of Binyamin. And Binyamin is called Yidir Hashem. We sensed in the closeness of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to us that we should honor the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. If the Rabbeinu Shel Olam told us something, it's strange. He's marching to the sea. Who could march into the sea? The Rabbeinu Shel Olam told us. Dabar Abba Yisrael V'Yisrael. Our response to the love of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam for us was, we're going to fight for the schus to go into the sea first. Not to be in the back of the line, to be in the front of the line. What's going to happen when you go into the sea? Who knows? The Rabbeinu Shel Olam said to go. We responded to the chiba, the love that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam had for us, by vying to enter the Yam first. So the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says, all of you are committed, Shevet Binyamin and Shevet Yehuda, to honor me, and therefore you're worthy of my blessing, of my bracha. And this really is the essence of the Chag. The essence of the Chag is, all the tircha, everything that we're ready to do, is for what reason? Kach tzivani habayim. We want to honor the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam has asked us to do this. And what is the Rabbeinu Shel Olam's response to us? If this is the commitment that you have to me, then you're worthy of my bracha. The realization of ima anochi b'tzara, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam stands with us in every situation. And in the darkest hours, we can also see the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, the redemption is not distant. the realization that we sense the Abba, the love of the Rabbeinu Shalom for us. And in our response to that, the Rabbeinu Shalom gives us his bracha. This is the essence of what this Chag is about. The Chag is to rise above all the obstacles that stand in the way. I often say this is the ultimate proof that the Torah is min hashamayim. There's no human being that could have dreamed up this yontem and gotten away with it. It would have stoned him and thrown him out. Only the Rabbeinu Shalom himself could create such a yontem. It's a mountain to climb. But by climbing the mountain, we demonstrate our love of the Rabbeinu Shalom. And when we get to the top of the mountain, we zeicha, we merit the Rabbeinu Shalom's bracha. Now, there are practical things that we have to do to get ready for the Yom Tov. But I do want to talk first about the things we shouldn't do. That's to me more important almost than the things we should do. So, I found that Rabbi Yosef Zatzal is my soulmate in this. And he writes the following. And it's very interesting, in fact, that he took this approach. Because generally he had a very, very strict approach to halacha. He was not quick to be lenient in general. But when it comes to Bedikas Chametz, did he pull out the stops? And he says the following. He says, any place that you can readily see when you clean, and you cleaned it v'yontuf, is exempt from Bedikas Chametz. That's it. There's no Chametz there, that's it. He says, it's better than the Bedika. The cleaning supersedes the Bedika. And you don't have to go there. So anything that you can readily access under a bed, if you move the bed away and you clean under the bed, you're not mechuyev to do bedikas chametz under the bed. So if you have a non-Jewish, if you have a Jewish cleaning lady, so you're certainly fine. If you have a non-Jewish one, then what I suggest is once she finishes each area of the house, go and check for yourself. When she's about to put everything back where it belongs, go and check that the whole area that she can check is clean. There's no chametz there. Now, what are we looking for? It's interesting. He writes the same thing that Ramosha Feinstein Zatzal wrote. We're not looking for tiny crumbs of chametz. We're looking for pieces of chametz that are big enough that we may be tempted to eat them. Crumbs, the Gemara says, Mamela Batle, a bottle on there, null and void on their own. You don't have to do anything about them. Moshe Feinstein Zatzal wrote this, and I saw that Rabbi Yosef Zatzal wrote exactly the same thing. Now, this resolves about, he says, where's the real Bedikas Chametz? The real Bedikas Chametz is in places which are hard to access, that you have to do Bedika. That's the real Bedikas Chametz. And those are the places that you really have to check very, very carefully on the night of the Bedikah. A place that's hard to access. A place that's easy to access and to see. If you cleaned it, that's it. He says that's greater, that's more significant than any Bedikas Chametz that exists. And he goes so far as to say that if you cleaned, actually went around carefully to clean your house, then he says the minhag that we have to put out the 10 pieces of bread is mitzvah adin yemechuyev to put them out. Because otherwise, he said, you won't be able to make a bracha on the Bedikas Chametz. Because the house is boduk already. It's clean from chametz. So this is his basic approach. And for that reason, he writes that svarim do not have to be checked for chametz. Because you can't have an edible piece of chametz inside a sefer. How big could the piece of chametz be? And they got the sefer closed and back on the shelf. Right. And besides the fact that even if a crumb usually spills on it, usually you shake it out before you put it away. But he doesn't advise bringing it to the table on Pesach. If you bring it to the table during the year, or if you eat while you're learning during the year, you shouldn't bring it to the table on Pesach. Why? Because the tiniest crumb could make your food usser. So we have to keep it away from the food. But there's no obligation to look for it. and to be concerned about. Now, if we just kept this in mind, we'd solve a huge amount of the problem. You know, Rav Scheinberg Zatzal used to say, there's a mitzvah of Simchas Achag. And every time we come to create chumras that we don't have to do, we're tearing apart a mitzvah sasei of b'samachta b'chagecha. Do what we're supposed to do. You know my proposal. I'm trying to convince a guy to start a campaign for this. A sticker campaign. We're going to make May 15th, National Jewish Spring Cleaning Day. You know, Pesach is not for spring cleaning. Forget about it. It's to get rid of chametz. And if you don't have little children in your house, then you don't have too many places you have to look. He says, in your bedroom closet, you don't put chametz. In your pockets, so the suit that you wear, or whatever, just put your hands in and check. If you can put your hands in and check and see there's no chametz, that's it. You don't have to do anything more than that. If you have little kids, that's something else. Then the whole house is muchzik that it has chametz. Kanayinahar, the little kids go, you know, wherever they want, and they, you know, I still remember when I lived in Kew Gardens, I was doing bedikas chametz, and in the milachik silverware drawer, I lifted up the silverware box, and under the silverware box was a sandwich. One of my kids decided that's it, you know, they didn't want to eat, they didn't want their mother or me to bother them about eating, so they ditched it, you know. I decided then that, you know, if you have little kids, the whole house is muchzik. It's clear that it has chametz, not even a shayla. But we need to do what we need to do. Not in excess. This yontif has enough mitzvahs to do that we don't have to find excessive things to do. There's plenty. There's a huge amount of mitzvahs to do. And just the things we have to do are significant. So I don't think anyone's bored that, you know, we don't have enough to do. We're looking for something else, you know. You know, Shavuos, you have to figure out maybe to make another cheesecake or something before, you know, because whatever, there's no sukkah to put up. We don't have to worry about a lulav and esrog. We're not cleaning the house for chametz. So, you know, in Arab Shavuos, we think, oh, maybe an extra, another cheesecake, you know, this type of cheesecake only. Before Pesach, we don't need to worry about it. There's plenty to do. Now, I want to go what we do have to do, and I tell you, you know, they have the advertisement, though. They used to have the advertisement. You know, I have a dollar and a dream. So I tell you all the time, my dream is, and I guess the Rabbeinu Shlomo is not maskim, he likes it better this way. But my dream is that one day I'm going to win the lottery, and I'm going to buy a house next door to my house. And I'm going to use it just on Pesach. That's it. And everything is going to be set up. Oh, Pesach, Kalim, Pesach. This, the table will be set a whole year. Just put a little, you know, something. So we'll just take off that there's no dust. The silverware will be waiting, you know, from last Pesach, you know. And that's it. We'll walk in, and everything will be there. After Pesach, we'll tiptoe out, we'll lock the door, and that's it, you know. That's my dream. I have a dollar and a dream. But I said the Rabbeinu Shalom, I guess, is not maskim. The tircha shal mitzvah, the fact that we have to exert ourselves to do a mitzvah, is a very, very great thing. The Arizal of the Shlo, I don't remember which one it is, wrote that in the tircha shal mitzvah, in exerting himself to do a mitzvah, he found the greatest closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I guess the Rabbeinu Shalom doesn't want me to fulfill my dream. So that being the case, and we do have to consider how to kosher the kitchen. You know, it is a mitzvah to eat on yontif, so we have to have the kitchen functioning. But we'll try to do this in systematic fashion. I spent a lot of time laying it out, so it should proceed in a very systematic way. Now, the place to begin koshering is inevitably the stovetop, because one of the necessities of koshering is we have to have hot water. So whatever generates the hot water is the first thing that you have to kosher. So that's the stovetop. So let's make the following observations. I don't know why it's not in vogue here. It's not in vogue by me either. But, you know, my relatives in Eretz Yisrael, they have a new stovetop for Pesach. Comes Pesach, They unscrew the stovetop, take the whole thing away, they put on a new one and hook it up, and that's it. Comes Pesach, end of Pesach, they put it away and bring back the chametz sticker one. It's not in vogue yet, I don't know why. But, and the stovetop is one of the things that we can't really properly kasher. It's usually made of some enamel type of surface. Even if it's a metal surface, we put hot pots on it. There's not a good way to kasher it. So we have to wash it well. And ultimately, we're going to have to cover it well. There's nothing else to do with it. Now, besides cleaning off the top, we should do some extent of cleaning of what's underneath. We don't have to go crazy about what's underneath. The, whatever chametz fell through underneath, you know, the where the cooking area is, into the kishkes of the oven, even if the drawer's open and you can take it out, nothing is jumping up from there onto the Pesach pots. So we don't have to go nuts about it, you know. Take, clean it out a little bit and wash it a little and go on. That's not important. And the gas jets, where the gas comes out of, certainly there's no big melocha that's involved. They usually tend to be clean all the time because of the fire, everything burns off. If they're not, wash them well. And we have two choices after that, basically. Either the stovetop is an electric one, or a gas one. If it's an electric one, put it on high in 10 minutes or less, probably 5 minutes, it'll be kosher already. It does not have to turn red to be kosher. And if you're really not sure if it's kosher, take a sheet of aluminum foil and throw it on there for 1 second. After about 5 minutes, you'll see it'll instantly turn red. So that you know you will kosher it way more than you have to kosher it. And it's kosher for Pesach. Now you need also to cover the drip pans. If you don't have special drip pans for Pesach, separate ones, then you have to cover them well with aluminum foil. If you have separate drip pans, then just replace them. Now, gas ovens are a little bit harder to kasher. Not much harder, but what you need to do is to take aluminum foil and make it a little bit of a teepee, you know, up, humped up a little bit, not like a bowl, not flat on the grate, because when you want to be able to put the flame up, and the flame should not hit the foil, because if the flame hits the foil, it's going to burn a hole in the foil. And basically what you want to do is the foil should trap the heat under it, and for about 15 minutes, and that burner is now kosher l'Pesach. Now, don't try to take a sheet of aluminum foil and put it over the whole oven top in one shot, because you're going to singe the enamel, and you will not appreciate it the rest of the year. So do it each one separately, do one or two at a time, and then you will finish with them, and they take about 15 minutes apiece, and they will be kosher. Now, if you have a grate which is not directly on the fire, which some ovens do, so you should not be using that on Pesach altogether. You know, if you want, they're hard to kasher that part of the oven. You do have to, if you want, you could take it and put it on a fire or put it in the oven and kasher it and then use that grate also. But it's where it is in place, if it's not directly over the fire, it's hard to kasher in that particular place that you find it. Now, the stovetop itself, you should do one of two things. You want to make sure that you do this job once, that you do it before Yontif, and you don't have to repeat it during Yontif itself. So therefore, you have one of two choices. There is this very, very heavy foil. I know initially it came from Eretz Yisrael, it may be made here as well. And it's basically, you almost feel like you have a piece of aluminum in your hand. It doesn't feel like foil. And you can bend it like you bend a piece of metal. But it's pliable enough that you can bend it, but it's very, very thick. That in my love, that is, if you cover your stovetop with it, the enamel parts, so because you don't want a hot pot to touch them during Pesach, this is not going to tear. It's not going to pop a hole. At the end of Yontif, if you carefully take it off, you do have to be a little bit careful handling the edges that you don't get cut, because it's thin and hard metal. It's not soft like foil. And therefore, you have to be careful a little bit handling it that you don't cut your finger while you're working with it. But it's not going to tear during Yontif. So you'll have no problems. You're not going to come all of a sudden, there's a hole in the floor, what do I do next? You know, I have to tear it off and start again in the middle of Yontif to bother, Chalamoy, to bother with it. If you don't have this foil, then you need to get the heaviest gauge aluminum foil that you can find and put two layers on. Because one layer is sooner or later going to tear. With two, you probably make it through the Yontif. Okay, I think we covered everything now that has to be done with the stove. Oh, one more thing about the stovetop is you do have to be careful is not to cover the vents. You may have vents from the oven in the back. So you have to leave those vents open because the oven does have to be able to vent. So if you have vents, you have to punch holes in the foil there so that the oven can continue venting.
Just leave that part open.
What? Then leave it open. What?
The vent part.
You
just not cover that.
Oh, whatever. Yeah, if it's a little place, you could leave that open. Fine. Now, you also have to, around the stovetop, two things. You should line the backsplashes all around, because steam does pop out of the pots onto the backsplashes. They're pretty close to the pots. And the area over the pots you should cover with aluminum foil. Whether you have a hood there the whole year, the hood, you don't want to try cleaning the hood for Pesach. It's way too difficult. You're going to take the whole thing down and apart. It's not a thing you can readily clean. And therefore, you should, whatever's on top of the pots, whatever lies over, I mean, it's the microwave, the flash should go, the microwave is there. I run foil across it. And therefore, if any steam does go up from the pots, it hits that and not anything which could have been touched by chametz during the year. Yes.
But does it have to be double layer of that?
No, you don't need a double layer there. No. No double layer necessary. It's not the only reason for the double layer on the bottom is because you rub pots against it and you're going to eventually pop a hole in it. One other thing. You should take the knobs off the stove, soak them for a while in ammonia and water, and it's a good idea to put them in the sink and dump hot water upon them, and then put them back on the stove. So this is everything that has to do about the stovetop.
Does that have to be a kosher sink?
We'll come to that, and if the sink wasn't used for the last 24 hours, it's fine. Yes. It's a good idea because you may touch it with a hot pot which is wet or whatever, so it's better to kosher it.
I'm reading this aluminum tent.
Yeah.
So the grates still have to go into the oven?
No, the grates don't have to go into the oven. The oven is overkill. I'm just saying, if you have some stoves have a grate which is not directly on top of the fire, then you take a pot off and you put it on there. So that needs that you should. That you should either move on top of the fire or put it in the oven.
So if you have grates that are all connected to each other, you can move the pot along it. There's certain stovetops where the grates all connect to each other.
Sometimes yeah.
There's no area to put the pot onto the stovetop. Like that strip in the middle, there's no such possibility. So by putting out that tent over, you're still covered, right? You don't have to put them into the oven.
Again, I'm not sure what your question is exactly.
So some ovens have four grates.
Yes.
One, two, three, four. Some of them have it configured, or like with a five burner stovetop.
Yeah.
That the grates are configured such that you can slide the pot from grate to grate without putting it.
Yeah, so I don't like the part in the middle. So either the part in the middle you have to move at one point to put it directly over the fire and cover it. That would be the best thing, or to put it in the oven, one of the two. Yeah. What?
If you have childproof covering on top of your knob, do you have to get new ones?
No, do the same thing that I told you for the knobs. Yes?
If you cover the stovetop with foil, then it's okay if a pad on paper touches it?
Yes. That's why you're putting it there. Now, this is a problem. I never recommend, and I don't want to talk about it tonight, the buying of glass top stoves. Glass top stoves are a problem because you can't really cover the glass. If you do cover the glass, it's going to shatter. So consequently, if you have one and you want to know what to do about it, Pesach, I'll speak to you privately. It's not the best of solutions, but it's the only solution. But that's not the way to go. Now, from stovetops, now we can kasha the sink. Now, the first number one rule about the sink is to close the hot water 24 hours before kashering and make sure you don't pour anything hot into the sink for 24 hours. Yes?
What happens if you have a sink that's not a kosher sink all year round, it's an old thing, it's enamel,
yeah,
and you make sure you have inserts in the whole bit, would you do the sink? Do you still have to go to the
process? I would do it anyhow, because enamel, like I said, is some question if it's kosherable or not, so we should at least avail ourselves, if we can, of dumping hot water on it. Yeah. You could use the cold water, yes, but what I advise you to do is close the hot water check valve, because otherwise someone's going to manage after 18 hours to put the hot water on, guaranteed. Now, once you succeed in getting through 24 hours with the hot water off, and no hot in the oven, in the sink, I mean, you want to remove all the stoppers you use the whole year. You want to remove all the stoppers you use the whole year. If the strainer is removable, it unscrew that and replace it. And then you're ready to begin. You should pour some ammonia down the drain and let it stay there for about, at the end probably for about 20 minutes, and then flush it out. So, because food falls down there, not all of it deteriorates immediately. So we want to make sure that none of it remains edible from before Yontif.
Bleach.
Yeah, bleach. I like ammonia better. You could use bleach also. And do it afterwards, because otherwise you could do it before if you have time. You want to put it down and wait 20 minutes and then flush it out. Either way, I don't have a problem. Now, you should take hot water and you should slowly pour it over, directly pour a stream of hot water on every spot of the sink. It takes a number of kettles to do a sink. That's assuming, again, that you have a stainless sink. If you have a stainless sink and you pour hot water all over it, that's fine. With one caveat, and that's assuming that you don't put hot pots into it normally during the year. If you don't normally put hot pots into it directly into the sink, then this is enough just to dump hot water on every part of the sink, including the spouts on the faucets. And underneath the spout, you should splash some hot water on the bottom part of it as well. And that will be kosher. Now, if you have a sprayer in the sink, sprayers come in different fashions. If they're metal, you can pour hot water on them and kosher it. If the whole sink works with a sprayer or something, that's the only way you can get the water out. If you can readily replace it with a Pesach thicker one, fine. If you can't, then dump hot water all over it, including the hose. And the same is true if you have a sprayer which is metal, then you can dump hot water on it and on the hose and use them on Pesach. Now, if... what?
Otherwise, just cover it up,
that's all. And put it out of action for a week. Now, if you put hot pots into the oven, then you have really two choices. Preferably, what you should do is what's called taking a hot stone. You take a stone, you put it directly into the stovetop, and you get it very hot. You pick it up with a pliers, and you need someone that's used to working with things that are a little bit dangerous. Put it down on the oven, pour the hot water, and go over it with the stone, and the water will sizzle off, and that's the same as putting a hot pot on it, and that's 100% kosher. Now, if there's a reason that that's impossible to do, it's preferable to cover that, to get an insert. And for whatever reason you can't, or it's too difficult, then it's just enough to dump the hot water on it. But that's really not the way to go. There is, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that even though the principal aspect of koshering is to kosherize it in the way that it's generally used, but if there is a use for it, which is a sometimes use, we should kasher to take care of that as well. Chofetz Chaim cites the Beis Meir that if that proves to be difficult or too difficult to do, that it's enough to do it the way it's generally used. But we do have other solutions here. We could use, as I said, a hot rock. If that doesn't work, we could also cover it as well. So those generally are what should be done. Now, if you have an enamel sink, then you should still pour hot water on it, but then you do have to cover it. You can cover it either with one of those plastic inserts, or you can cover it with aluminum foil, whichever one you're more comfortable with, one of the two. Now, also, and I mentioned before, you should pour ammonia down the drain when you're finished and let the ammonia stay there for about 20 minutes and then rinse it out. And, of course, you have to cover the black splashes, you know, next to the sink, too. If you to change the strainer on the faucet, you should change if it unscrews. This, to me, this is probably the most difficult job. The most difficult job is koshering the sink. The hardest job. The handle is good to pour water on the handles. You're not mechuyev, but it's good to pour water on it. If you want, you're not mechuyev to cover them. You know, usually, the way most, it depends a little bit. If you have typical faucets, the faucets are set very, very far back. It's not usual that you're going to get hot pots or hot things going directly on them. You know, if you have one of these that's over the center of the sink, so you're going to kosher it anyhow. So it's either way. Yeah. Pesach tikka kettle. Kasher with a Pesach tikka kettle. That's why you stew the stove first. So then again, you can get the Pesach tikka kettles. Then you just put on the cold water and flush it out.
If you're not going to cover it, if you don't want to cash it, I'll say, is it enough to just put an insert over it?
It's enough to cover it. I prefer that you do, but if it's, again, if it proves to be too difficult, cover it, and that suffices.
Does the water have to be right off the fire? If it's convenient to pour it into
a... No, don't pour it. You have to pour it directly from the kettle itself. You can't put it into anything else. And to make life easier, in my house, we own three kettles. And we own three kettles only for one reason. We don't use so much hot water that we need three kettles on Pesach. But for koshering, I need three kettles, because I keep them, I put all the three fires on, and I keep the water boiling. And that way, it takes long enough as it is. We don't realize the surface area of a sink, because it has five sides to it. There's a tremendous amount of surface area. You know, we think a sink is a little sink, but we don't realize all the area that the inside of the sink actually comprises.
Do we have to be concerned that the water will splash back onto the kettle?
No, it's Eino Ben Yomo. We don't kasher after this Man Iser, and it hasn't been used for 24 hours. So nothing can happen, even if it splashes. Even if you put it down in there, nothing can happen. Yeah. Splash it up. Wash it and splash the water up. Like this, with an upwards motion.
Oh, but it has to be boiling hot water.
Yeah, from the kettle. I take the kettle and I...
If you're not using it...
Yeah, if it's...
If you're not using a kettle to make the hot water, is it an African meaning whether it's a flasher pot, a milk pot, and a boiling water? Not using a kettle, using a pot.
If it hasn't been used for 24 hours, it could be anything you want. It could even be trying. Hey, Beryl, where's Beryl? Mr. Joe.
one of the tall water urns that holds several gallons.
Yes.
We use like on shops. If nothing really, you say it shouldn't be used for 24 hours, but if nothing really gets on it, I mean, maybe some coffee splashed up.
I have one rule. If you use it in the kitchen the whole year, that's it. You don't use it on Pesach. Simple.
Okay. but if it's not Ben Yom.
Yeah, but you're still on Pesach with Mach, but even if it's not a Ben Yom. The problem with Pesach is, you know, 95% of my shaylos are solved with one of two things. Either, and which is most of the time, most of the shaylos, if somebody took out the fleishiks and mixed with the milachiks and this and that, The pot that they cooked it in wasn't used in the last 24 hours. So the food is at least kosher. Maybe the pot has to be kosher, but the food is kosher. And in case that doesn't work, then we go on to see if this becomes null, that there's 60 times as much, a little bit, a little spot of something shot out, butter, that shot into the chicken soup. Okay, so it's null and void. The problem with Pesach, especially according to the Ashkenazim, was we trashed both of these rules. Right? The first rule, at least the Sfardim have, that if you didn't use it in the last 24 hours, it still remains kosher. So they solved most of their problems. It's hard to make things treif among the Sfardim. Among the Ashkenazim, it's a problem. And if you use the Chometz Chaim Pasuk, if you use the Pat Zena Ben Yoyim, you will have to throw the Chometz out, to throw the food out. That's number one. Number two is everyone generally agrees, just about everyone, la halacha, is that there's no bittul on Pesach. So even the tiniest amount of chametz, right, there is a sheet of Rav Achoy that there is bittul, so we use that together with other things if the going really gets sticky, you know, to try to save our necks. That's why the Pesach is a problem, because the standards that we use for kashrus are much higher than the ones that we use a whole year. Could do that too, for that matter. But listen, I don't like, I'm just telling you how to get done, that you're not going to have shaylos at the end. You know, once you're going to start to use a chametz dikah pot, you're going to wind up one day, you're going to find out that it was a ben yom pot too. That's life. You use the Pesach one that was locked up a whole year, it's not going to make problem. When you're finished, you'll be finished. You know, I have to tell you, practical approaches. You know, I listen to the horror stories for 2 weeks, you know, before Pesach, you know. So I'm trying to make life easy enough for you that you don't become one of those horror stories. Life easy for me too. Yeah.
Does water get hot enough in like an electric hot pot, in a Pesach
one? Which type are you talking?
Happier. The kind like you just boil water for, you know, small
like that. Yeah, they get hot enough. The water boils. The big electric urns, it does not get hot enough. The water actually has to be at a rolling boil.
What about, you know, in the sink, let's say you have a stainless steel sink, and you don't put ever hot, because you have one sink, so obviously I don't put anything down because it's a tray, you know, a sink. But it could happen that sometimes a pot might have been
accidentally. Oh, don't worry about it. You don't need to worry about it.
Also, longer before the boiling water.
Yes, yes, yes. You'll ask me privately or whatever. Someone will ask you from your family. I'll explain to them. If you don't understand how to do it, you shouldn't be doing it, because it's not just forgetting for halacha, just for safety's sake. You know, there are. It's not an easy thing to do. You have to be certain. You know, understand what you're doing, and you need to be comfortable working with things that are very, very hot. Very, very hot.
Some of the stores sell a kit with like a metal enclosure.
Yeah, I'm not happy with that kit.
It's like rocks and touch.
Exactly. I don't think it was properly made. I would not have designed it that way. I don't know who did, and I'm not happy about it. Oh. Now, countertops. Let's go to countertops. Now, generally, let's assume the following, that if you have a real stone countertop, whether in Israel you have marble, you have granite here. I'm not talking a compound stone. I'm not talking a composite stone. I'm talking a real piece of stone. Straight from nature, from Mother Nature. If that's what you have, all you have to do is dump hot water on it all over, and it's kosher for Pesach. Now, I'm assuming in general that most people don't put hot pots on countertops, because that's the way to whatever. I know someone that did, and he cracked it. And I was speaking to a worker, whatever, once in a commercial kitchen, He says, a guy came, he climbed up on my counter. He says, I wanted to kill the guy. I paid $6,000 for my kitchen. He's going to crack it by climbing on it, you know. So most people don't put hot pots directly onto the stone countertop. So it's enough to, you generally speaking, just to pour hot water all over them and they're fine. And you have to cover the backsplashes all around because food does splash up while you're preparing it. If it is not real stone, if it's some type of composite or any other material, then it has to be covered. Once it's covered, you really don't have to dump hot water on it. It's not a necessity to do so if you cover it well. So that's countertops. Countertops I find less daunting than the sink. The sink is, to me, is the most daunting challenge. What? What? Now, yeah.
Clarify, you said if it's composite stone, it must be covered, but you don't have to pour hot water over it first?
Correct, you don't have to. Yeah.
Doesn't matter how thick the covering is,
for example, the heat. Well, the heat doesn't bother me. The covering should be such that it has some aspect of waterproofing to it. In other words, that you should not be able to get hot water to go through it and get in contact with the sink under, with the material under it. Now, most of what they sell nowadays, they have these like plastified things that they sell in the hardware stores. Those, they're not porous. They don't get liquid through them. If liquid will spill on it, it'll stay on the top. So it's not an issue. And they're thick enough. Now, ovens. One little surprise with ovens, just the world is changing, it keeps changing around us. The world is not static. First thing you have to do with any oven is to clean it. And that's, is to get an oven cleaner, and you should get yourself a pair of goggles for a few dollars so you protect your eyes. And don't put your head into the oven, because this stuff is very caustic, and you can really get hurt if you put your head in. And you have to clean the oven. And this is true even if you have a self-cleaning oven, because if you don't clean it and it's greasy, you can wind up with a fire. I know whatever, someone, he was the night before Yontif, he put on the self-cleaning and the flames went shooting out the vents in the back because he was handy enough that he grabbed the fire extinguisher which he had in his kitchen and put out the fire and whatever, he survived it. But you don't need that happening. And the self-clean, so if you have self-cleaning, if you clean it, then you have to clean carefully. If the doors come off, the areas just right outside, where you have a little, sort of like a little shelf right outside the oven where the door opens to get all the chametz out of there. Clean around the gaskets and put on the self-cleaning for 3 hours with the racks inside, and it's kosher for Pesach. Now, basically, what has changed is the following. In the earlier, very earlier models, the early models, or earlier models of the self-cleaning ovens, the door used to get much hotter. And as the models went on, the door does not get as hot anymore. That's what the technical people are telling me. And also with older ovens, you get inside, you can look in, a lot of them are vented through the door itself. That's the way they vent. And if you look at the glass, inside the glass, you'll see a greasy buildup. So For these reasons, and because the world, in fact, is changing continually in the direction that the doors are getting less hot, it's just a wise idea to adopt the practice to cover the door. And therefore, even if when it's going to reach the point, or if it has reached the point in your particular model that it's no longer going to be hot enough, you're not going to have a problem for Pesach. So you won't have to say, oh, 5 years ago I should have changed. We'll just adopt the change now. And to cover the oven doors, the inside of the oven doors, you take long pieces of aluminum foil and wrap them that you should come all the way around to the outside. Now, I like to take the very, very heavy foil because it comes in big sheets. And with one piece of foil without a seam, I can cover up the whole door on the inside and then bend it around to the outside. And it's fine. If you have a non-self-cleaning oven, put it on the highest temperature for about 3 hours, and then you have to cover the inside with foil. It's a painstaking job, and you have to do it very carefully. You make a U around it with one piece, around one side, around the back, around the other side. Once you add, now you can put initially a piece on the bottom of the oven that'll stay. And once you have the U, then you can install a piece on top of it against the top of the oven. The U-shaped piece will hold it up. Then you have to press very, very carefully and slowly along with a track saw for the racks, so that you have room to sort of, it's tight in that area and you can put the racks back inside. You have to press it very, very close to the walls. And what I recommend is put in the racks very, very carefully then, and don't take them out until after Pesach. Because if you slide them in and out, they're going to tear the foil apart. So press them in very, very carefully, so that you actually have see tracks again, and then put in the racks very carefully and leave them inside and just take the pots out and leave the racks in place.
Does that apply to Sfarim also?
What?
Sfarim and Ogah also?
I don't speak about Sfarim. I told you, I'm a Kana Rav Avadya. I found out about him when I was in Eretz Yisrael around 1968. Rabbi Neumann Olav HaShalom had met up with him. And I was nispal from the fact that I remained nispal that a person could know Ashkenazi and Sephardi Shittas to such an extent that when you came to him, he would ask you if you're a Sephardi or Ashkenazi, and then he would give you a psak according to your Messiah. I mean, this like off the charts. I have a hard enough time keeping track of the Ashkenazim. A little bit, I've learned Sephardim and Hogim a little bit, because in the years that I taught, I tended to have Sephardi Shittalmidim. So I did pick up on some of the things. You're covering the inside. You don't need boiling water. It's for a whole year, not for Pesach. No. We'll get to that. Now, if you have a non-self-cleaning oven, you need to do one more thing, and that's take the racks and put them into somebody's self-cleaning oven for 3 hours. Now, the racks are very, very hard to kosher without that, because you have a lot of T's where they cross each other, and they're very hard to clean the connections. In commercial kashrus, we do things that you wouldn't dare do in your kitchen. Now, in commercial ovens, are made of totally steel on the top. They have no enamel. So we don't have to be afraid how hot they're going to get. Nothing's going to happen to them, no matter. If you come into a commercial kitchen, you want to kasher the racks. So what we do is we take all the racks that they have, and that there could be a dozen racks on one side of the kitchen. We pile them up on a six-burner steel top stove, we cover it over with aluminum foil, and we just put the thing on and leave it there for hours. And eventually, it turns red in there. And that there's nothing that remains. Any dirt that might have been there is incinerated, and it comes, probably it's leaving gomer by the time we're finished. When the non-Jewish workers see what we do for Pesach, they say, you know, before they should have these rabbis come a few times a year to clean the place up, because it's never so clean as it is, you know, when they finish on Erev Pesach. It doesn't happen.
What about if you're not going to be cooking? What do you have to do?
If you're not going to be cooking, put a piece of tape over your oven and close it up. Say, close for the holiday. That's it. Racks? No. You put, leave the racks in the oven, and that's fine.
Do you have to cover the sides?
You don't have to do anything. Just the door.
Okay.
That's when you have a non-self-cleaning. Okay. The worst is over. Listen, you want to, don't go crazy about it. It's basically going to burn everything up. If you really think that at the end of the self-clean cycle that there's something remained that you think is not burned up yet, then scrub it and put it on again. Yeah.
What about rust? Is that a concern?
Rust is certainly inside in a self-clean. Rust inside the oven is not a concern. We'll get to that. We're not up. I said the worst is over. Now we come to the easy parts.
So you said the door, you know, you have to, on a self-cleaning oven, you have
yes.
to go
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
Nothing happens.
Burn residue on the walls of the oven. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I said if it looks totally burned up, it's not a problem. If you think it's not totally burned up, scrub it again a little bit and put it on again. Most of it usually in a self-cleaning oven, it does flake off. It burns it up. It doesn't incinerate it. It's like an ash.
Flat, but it's like
ash.
It's black carbon.
It's carbon. It's not exactly. That's why the brisket has such a big share for matzah. Which time?
The clock receives so much heat from the cover of the aluminum near.
Where?
In the front. Here's the oven. Here's the four burners, and then the back, and the clock.
So I'll leave the oven uncovered. Leave the clock uncovered. I'll make holes. That's it. You don't have to. Don't ruin the thing for that reason. Okay. Now we come to the easy parts. The refrigerator does have to be cleaned for Pesach. You know, it certainly has chametz a whole year. All you really need to do is to wash it out well. Once you wash it out well, it's kosher for Pesach. However, now let me just tell you two things. First of all, make sure to clean around the gasket well. And also on the top of the gasket, you could be surprised how many crumbs of things wind up there, somehow falling off the top of the refrigerator or whatever. Clean the top of the gasket too. Now, if you tend to put hot pots directly into the refrigerator during the year, especially if you have glass shelves inside, you may do so, then you should certainly cover the shelves before Pesach. If you don't normally put hot pots directly into it, you do not have a need to cover the shelves. If you want to cover them, it makes life easier for you, particularly if you have wire racks. It can make life, because you don't have to be so super, super crazy careful about getting them clean. But also, if you do, the fridge doesn't work as well either, so it's everything has a trade-off in life.
But when you say hot, you mean that solidified, right?
Yes. That's, yes.
If I put something hot into the fridge, I usually put a piece of cardboard.
Then you don't worry about it. Then you're fine. Okay.
Why you have solidified, you know, water for the...
Not for what?
You disagree.
No. She just said if the pot was that hot. Okay, not... We're not dumping water into the refrigerator.
No. Enough.
Get an Arab sabal, we'll take the fridge to the mikvah, put it in. Now, microwaves. We'll divide microwaves into two. There are those that have steel insides and those that have plastic insides. If you have a plastic inside, just tape the thing closed, right, not for Passover use, and forget about it. We do not typically kasher plastic for Pesach, certainly not lechatchil. If you have a steel inside, then you have to clean it very, very well. It's a little bit time-consuming to clean it well, but it's quite doable. And after that, take out the rack, whatever rack you have inside, if you have a steel rack, and take out the turntable, remove that, put them away for Pesach. Pour a little bit of water on the floor of the microwave, and where you pour the water, put down, I take a double plastic cup, one inside the other, and I fill it up with water. And what I discovered with a double, if I took a single plastic cup, the cup shrinks from the heat, and the water goes all over the place. But if I put a double cup, the outer cup maintains the inside one, and it doesn't shrink. Put it on for about 10 minutes, and you'll feel after, when you open it, you'll feel that the whole inside is hot. The steam went all over, and it's kosher l'Pesach.
How about Pyrex?
Pyrex? We don't kosher glass for Pesach.
No, I mean plastic in the microwave sometimes releases unhealthy chemicals.
Right, we don't kosher anything which... you can use Pyrex. You have a... If you haven't used it for 24 hours and you take a kosher of the piece of glass, yes, you could use that too. Yeah, not a problem.
You can't use it for 24 hours.
Anything that you kasher, the rule is you don't use for 24 hours before you kasher it. Dishwashers are best not to kasher. If you have a stainless steel dishwasher and you want to kasher it, and you really have some compelling need, you can kasher it for Pesach. But it's questionable, you know, by cleaning it well and running it well, but it's not glatt kosher, it's not going to be. Okay, we'll leave it at that. So I don't recommend doing it, but I said if with a compelling need, you can clean it out well and run a cycle with soap, and it'll be kosher for Pesach. But you know, the problem is that when you really need it, you can't use it. And when you can use it, you don't really need it. You know, when you'd like to have the dishwasher, you know, after the Seder, the first night, you'd like to have the dishwasher, you know, clean up the mess, you know. So for 2 days, you can't use it. The Chol HaMoed already, you either use plates or use throwaways, you know, it's not, you're not feeding 25 people anymore. So comes back to Yontif again when you might have a crowd, right, you can't use it. So what do you get? Tables. We do have to clean the table. And the basic point is to clean it well. And if it has a crack in it because it's a table that expands, so open up the place that it expands and clean well in there. I guarantee you, after a whole year, there's what to clean out from that crack. And after that, you should cover it with a heavy covering, the same type of those plastic type coverings, or a heavy cardboard, that's what we use on the kitchen table. And there should be some waterproof material over it, whether it's a plastic tablecloth or those plastic things, plasticized things, which they use nowadays. And that's basically the story. Now, what else do you might want to cut? You know, in general, I'm not a fan of kashering. It's not for our time and place. The pots are not made in a way that they're readily kasherable for Pesach. The ones for domestic use have curled edges, and you can't really clean them out fully. For the whole year, I have a terum not to use them, to put ammonia on, all types of a terum and tricks. But for Pesach, it's just not the way. The commercial ones don't have those cutely rolled edges, so you can go with it. And in a commercial setting, you can do things which you dare not do in your house. In a commercial setting, you have to realize there are stainless, and things are made of heavy steel. You can use torches on commercial things, and don't dare use a torch in your house. None of the things in your house are made to withstand it. So in general, I'm not a fan of kashering. You know, a couple of things, bechers, which it's sort of questionable if they need to be kashered altogether. Well, we kasher them since they lie around with the chametz. They get washed in the chametz dika sink. So clean them well, wait 24 hours, and you could do hagolah on the bechers and the trays. And also, if you have a leichter tray on the table, it's good to take it after you kasher the sink and dump hot water on it. And then you don't have to be concerned having it on the table on Pesach. I'd have to see it to tell you. I have no idea what it is. You know, there comes in different possibilities. Now, before Pesach, if you have, you know, children that have braces, or you have false teeth, so you should not eat hot chametz for 24 hours before the Zman Issa. So, if it's permanently in your mouth, or a removable crown. It doesn't come out. No. Don't worry. I wouldn't worry so much about it. But if you have, you know, things that are, you should not, you know, if you have false teeth or braces, particularly, you shouldn't eat hot chametz for 24 hours before. And the truth is, if you have braces altogether, you shouldn't eat chametz for about 24 hours before.
Even cold
chametz. It's very, very hard. It's interesting. People say, oh, tell me. One of my relatives, Rabbi, you're a big machmer. Then I went to speak to an orthodontist. Rabbi, you're a big makel. He says, don't ask, you know, how long do I open up the braces and this chametz tucked into them. God, I'm samech on the fact that the digestive juices in the mouth cause it to deteriorate. You know, we say by boser v'cholov after 6 hours is no longer considered boser anymore. But, you know, we should try to avoid eating, you know, hot salads. Clearly, if you have, you know, false teeth or braces, you should altogether not eat chametz for 24 hours before. Just you're never going to be able to clean it out fully. Yeah. What? Excuse me? Listen, who has time? You know.
Table
thing that turns around out.
Yeah.
And the plastic thing that goes underneath it turns it around.
I take that out also.
And you don't use it for baseball.
Correct.
So you need to buy a new set.
Nah, I just put things on the floor of the oven and it works fine.
It works.
It works. No problem. You can use a basic cleaner. You know, you don't... Yeah.
Do you need to buy a new towel?
Let's put it this way. Dish towels, you probably should have different ones. You know, the tablecloths, if they launder well and they don't have stains, you could use them on Pesach.
Great. Yeah, I think it's
like,
hours.
No. Anything kosher with heat does not need 24 hours. No, I didn't say you need two covers. I say you need one that has some thickness to it and to make sure that it's waterproof so you don't have hot water going through to the table.
That's fine,
though. Yeah, that's fine. Absolutely fine. So Rabbi Yisai, the Rabbi Nishom, should give you all strength. And it's interesting. Chavis HaLavavis writes a very interesting thing, and it's relevant to this, too. Chavis HaLavavis says that a big aspect of the love that we have for our children is because of all the effort that we put into raising them. When we invest heavily in something, we appreciate it very, very deeply. We invest heavily in this chag, and may the Rabbeinu Shalom grant that we should experience what I find really truly the most magical of Yom Tovim, is Pesach. There is nothing, you know, nothing that can compare to it, nothing in the Jewish consciousness that can compare to it. A person, he could be 100 years old, and you'll ask him how his father Seder was 90 years before, he'll tell you exactly. It's one of the magic moments in Yadus. Hatzlocha Rava, Chakosha B'Sameach. Better run out.